Those are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Welcome to A View of World Affairs from Greenwich. Politics, economy, history. A careful examination of the world's interrelationships and how they affect us, here in our country as well as here in Greenwich. And now here is your host, Fotis Baliakas.
Good morning, Greenwich. This is Fotis coming to you from AM 1490 WGCH in Greenwich. Hope you're doing well this little overcast and raining Saturday, but we still can go sailing. The weather is going to be nice. Today, we will talk about what makes a superpower. What is a superpower? What are the components of its power? And what hegemonic power looks like. We will examine all these pieces that, when you assemble them together, make up this statecraft of components that provide the statue of a sovereign state globally that can be a leader, can be followed. And what are the common things? What are the attributes that the rest of the world, the weakest or the not as powerful, will follow? So in addition to the hegemony and superpower concept, we will also touch upon what is happening now, the last week since we last spoke. What is happening with the war in Ukraine? What is happening in the Middle East, the evil axis? We had a couple of developments. Obviously, Xi Jinping visited Russia, they shook hands, they hugged and kissed, all these good things. And at the same time, we had the Japanese prime minister visiting Kyiv. So there were two antithetical international affair events happening at the same time. China got involved in the Middle East as a broker. And as I mentioned before, it was not more of a China doing it. It was more of a Saudi Arabia being the active participant, looking to attract the United States' attention because they believe that they have not been given their fair share of attention. And they're looking to flex their muscles, mostly economic, because of the oil wealth that is coming to the country. Most lately, they wanted to participate in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is an alliance in the Eurasian geography. And we will talk about that as well. So in the Middle East, we have a couple of things happening. Iran and Saudi Arabia shaking hands. They're going to change in the next month and a half remaining in the time frame that they agreed, that will open up each other's embassies and start to behave as regular citizens, maybe civilized. Another thing that is happening is Syria, following the major earthquakes that happened between Turkey and Syria. Syria is coming back now into the countries, into the fold of the world, and they have been going around shaking hands with the Arab world, and it looks like the Arab League may accept them back into their fold after the civil war started in 2014 or so. They had taken them out. So Syria is active, and that is somewhat of a work by Russia. So now we have China and Russia being active in the Middle East, a little bit of a vacuum that we have left there. I'm not worried about it because those are temporary situations, I think. Obviously, Syria is in deep, deep trouble, probably will need in the range of $200 billion of funds to be found and to be used for the reconstruction of the country. So I don't think China will be putting a lot of money in that Marshall Plan, so to speak, or Russia. They don't have it. So it will come around to the EU and the US and the global financial system to make that happen. So I'm not that worried about that. North Koreans, they had severe food shortages. There were some reports of executions. So there's a lot of political strife going on there. But also they're still firing missiles. So they're still flexing their muscles. But, you know, they do have the weapons, but a small country, they wouldn't have the staying power to start and finish something unless China or Russia get involved in their side. So they're still there. They still want attention. North Korea is a state that is so supported by China and Russia. So they wouldn't go that far away from the guidance that the two powers give to them. Funny thing, Iranian naval ships found themselves visiting Brazil after Lula visited the United States. Actually, the schedule was that they were going to be visiting Rio before Lula visited the United States, and the optics were so wrong that they reversed it. But nevertheless, not an egg in our face, because the Iranian ships... what is the common theme there with Brazil? And we will talk about the BRICS a little bit, and South Africa, another one of the BRICS that hosted Chinese and Russian naval warships for exercises. Obviously, these are very surface-level exercises. They're so different, all of them. They don't have a combined force that you can say this is a NATO in the making. So that is not too much of a worry. Although BRICS, standing for Brazil, Brazil, India, Russia, South Africa, and China. That term was coined in the early 2000s when the world economy was booming, and these were the up and coming powers because of their economies, populations, positions, etc. But out of those BRICS, I would say Russia is not in good shape right now. China is the only one standing, maybe not as strong as it was before following COVID and their policies. South Africa, where are they? They haven't made any difference. India is the key here. India is a focal point. In Brazil, changing from the more conservative right wing to more leftist, communist, socialist government, it's confusing us. We don't know which way they're going. But nevertheless, with over 200 million of population and a good military and a very extractive economy, they're there. They're a power to be reckoned with. So those are the major things that are happening. And one more thing I mentioned before, that the expression that Finlandization, that no longer exists, because Finland, as of last week, having Turkey approved its membership for NATO, will be coming into the July meeting, the NATO July meeting of the prime ministers and secretaries of defense. They will be meeting, and Finland looks like it will be coming in as a standing member. Unfortunately, Sweden is still out. Unfortunately, Turkey and Hungary, both of them are holding back on that approval. The pressure is on them, on both of them, to make that happen. Finland is a very strong military power, obviously very strong economic state. Sweden is as much as good as Finland, and their constitution has been very open and liberal. They allow other countries with other opinions to speak up, and that is the problem that Erdogan in Turkey has, which he's using for internal purposes. For the up-and-coming elections, I believe, in May, where he's in trouble. He came in 2004 with the earthquakes that happened in Istanbul, Constantinople, and now it looks like he's losing power because of the earthquakes that happened in the southeast Turkey. So to be seen, I expect some delays, but ultimately I don't expect that Sweden will not be in. It's too much of a major power, military and economic, to join the fold and the alliance, and it will be, in my humble but accurate opinion, that they will come in sometime in 2023, after the United States and Germany will put some pressure on Turkey, and also following the elections there. So our major issue today, we're going to talk about the superpower. What is a superpower? And when there is more than one superpower, we're going from the unipolar system, which means that there's one central point where everything leads to a bipolar, where two opposing sides are there, that and there's a split, or the multipolar, where there are multiple centers of power in around the world, where different states fall into fold, and some of them are followers, some of them are coerced into falling into a category, some of them are willingly do so, and some of them are neutral. Good example is India. So the components of what will make a superpower, according to my my studies, are the following. Economy. Economy is, I think, the basis that starts everything else to flow. Energy is part of the economy because it supports the economy, and energy independence and security is critical. Then the projection of power, your diplomatic power, your military power, especially the blue navy, blue water navy. What kind of a weaponry you have? Is the nuclear weapon acquisition threat of use, does that make a power? Alliances, how do they play in the sum of the total components? Technology, are these homegrown technologies or dependent technologies from outside? The legal and financial system that supports the economy, how strong that is it exportable, is it adaptable? Then the economy obviously depends, the GDP depends on population and workforce. So is the population, the size of population, does that matter? Is the landmass or the geography of the land a critical component? And with that comes the natural resources, and then some industrial capacity that comes into fold. So those are the items that I will be looking one at a time to examine where we are. And just to remind you that economy, such as diplomacy and military and energy and technology, are part of the state's statecraft that project their power outside the borders of each state. Following the 1991 collapse of USSR, the system that we had prior to that was considered a bipolar system. We had a political economic system in the West that was the liberal, democratic, capitalistic economy versus the autocratic, state-run, state-directed economy from the USSR, the Soviet Union. And upon the collapse of that, the system reverted to a unipolar, one, that's a Greek word, for one center. So now with the ascendance of China, we are discussing the unipolar system. I think the multipolar system is not there. There isn't any identified power that that it will be competing as a peer with the U.S., China, if we consider China to be the other polar. So that is still definitely, from my view, not a multipolar system. And I'm questioning if there is a bipolar system, and I will explain why. So economy matters. Size matters. So we have different measures of what the economy is and what it does and what the size of it is. So the United States, obviously leading the West and its multilateral and the rules-based law, rules-based and law-based system, we are the largest economy by output, by gross domestic product. And I have some statistics to explain that the United States is the largest economy with about 27 trillion of output, followed by China, Japan, Germany, India, UK, and France. Now, there were a lot of discussions if China will, you know, I remember, you know, 2020 will be the year that China will supersede the United States in total output, maybe 2025 and so forth, and it's not happening. And I don't see it happening in the foreseeable future for quite a few reasons. So, and we will examine some of those, and I will give you some quick run on the, obviously we know the United States economy, I don't need to go over that, but some points on the Chinese economy will bring those, will focus our minds as to what contributes to the GDP and why China may come short in superseding the United States. As suppressing the United States as the economic power. So there's a group of G7, seven countries, seven leading economies, and those are the ones that I mentioned before, from the U.S. all the way to France. And then there's another, it's called the G20, that includes, other than the seven that I mentioned before, includes Canada, Russia, Italy, Iran, Brazil, South Korea, Australia, Mexico, Spain, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Netherlands, and Turkey. And following closely to Turkey is Taiwan, Switzerland, Poland, Argentina, and Sweden. So critically, those 20-25 countries around the world that make up the leading powers, it is a major event where these countries concentrate wealth. And, you know, the U.S., somewhere between 25 and 27, there are a couple of definitions of is it by the World Bank or other organizations that make up that, the numbers in U.S. dollars equivalents. You know, the U.S. is at about 25 trillion, China about 18, Japan about 4.3, Germany about 4 trillion, India 3.47 trillion. UK 3.2, France 2.78. So those are the collective. But the most important thing in comparing is not the total GDP. Where the issue is on the strength of a country is not even the purchasing power parity. I think it lies in the per capita, the gross domestic product in total divided by the population. And that's what I think it is the key to say that a superpower's power in the economic terms lays into the per capita numbers. So just to compare, forget about Monaco and Liechtenstein and Luxembourg and Bermuda. These are, you know, high income, very low population countries, and they are, you know, in the stratosphere instead of in terms per capita. But Switzerland and Norway are leading, very close, 93,000 per capita, 89,000 per capita. The United States falls into the $69,000 to $70,000 per capita. That is a very high number for the 338 million of us and around the 25 trillion. Now, compare that to China. They are in the 12,000. Let me repeat that. U.S., 69 to 70,000 per capita. China, 12 to 12,500 per capita. Huge, huge difference. And there are, you know, a lot of, obviously, huge amount of countries in between. So the swing of which one is doing better in terms of superpower, it falls into the United States by far. And that is because the legal framework, the ownership system, the financial infrastructure, the banking system, it is something that has been used and adopted throughout the world. So in terms of the economic statute, the United States has it by far. The other countries are following, but this is one of our bright spots. Going to the energy independence and security, we are fortunate in the last administration to be among the top two producers of hydrocarbons. We had nearly 13 million barrels a day of oil produced in the United States. And we were the second, if not the first, in natural gas production. And we are among the major exporters as well. But we are among the top consumers of our own energy. So I believe that we have energy security, because we have many different forms of energy. We have nuclear energy that we need to supplement more. We have, obviously, the hydrocarbons. We have natural resources, our natural energy. We have enough rivers, not as much as Canada, but we do have some hydro. But we also have solar and wind. So by putting all of those together, we do have sufficient energy to supply for our economy, which demands energy, and that's where it is, as opposed to what is happening now in Germany, where the change from having most of their energy coming from Russia, crude oil and natural gas, now they're supplementing it from different sources, they will suffer. So they do not have sufficient energy. Therefore, they lost their energy security, and definitely they're not energy independent by far. They could have been if they decide and rationalize the use of nuclear power, like France has done, almost 75% of the energy in France is produced by nuclear energy. They could be there, but now what is happening is they're losing industrial capacity because they don't have that energy to distribute. And I'm sure the Germans and others who live there, they're not happy being cold and lowering their thermostats all the time in the winter. So the energy issue is critical. It's critical because, for example, China imports 60% of its oil and a lot of natural gas. It has one pipeline. Now they're building a second pipeline from Russia to supply them into China, into mainland China. They are very fearful that in an event of a conflict with the West, and I will not say the United States, I will say the West, they will lose their ability to import that natural gas. Energy, and they will revert back to some coal that they have. They're building more nuclear power plants, but they absolutely need fuels. They need the derivatives of crude oil in gasoline and diesel to run their economy. And generally speaking, the commercial economy runs on diesel, and some of the real estate runs on natural gas. So they will be, they definitely do not have energy independence or energy security. So the Strait of the Malacca, the very famous, you know, short passage there in Asia, it gives them headaches because it can be choked, and the supply of energy, other than other trade, will be stopped or will be diminished, and that will reduce their ability to produce more with less energy. So energy is critical. Now, does energy by itself make a superpower? No, but it's part of the equation. For example, Russia has energy coming out of their ears, hydrocarbons, obviously. They do have some nuclear. Not the best technology nuclear in the nuclear fission. Nevertheless, they're using it. And here we are in Ukraine. There are five nuclear power plants, one of which is the I'm not going to pronounce the name very well. It starts with a Z, Zaporizhzhia. Where they're the conflict now, actually, the two militaries are up against each other near that power plant, which is the largest installation of nuclear power plant in the world. And that gives everybody very uncomfortable levels about this conflict being on top of that power plant. So energy is part of the economy. Economy, in my view, is the top issue for a superpower. The next one is the states own the monopoly of violence. And what I mean by that is that the states raise army, they stand up armies or internal policing, and they own the means of violence, the weapons, either small scale or mass weapons of mass destruction. So they own the monopoly of violence. Here in the United States, the militia and individuals can own weapons, but not in such large scale. So I'm talking about what a state has as in large scale. And when we talk about large scale and weapons, we can't avoid talking about nuclear weapons. And they were the United States being the first one in 1945 to acquire the technology to use nuclear fission and fusion for the means of weaponization, and followed by Russia in 1949, and then China, UK, and France. So those five have signed a non-proliferation treaty that we want to contain the use of nuclear technology, especially for weaponization. So does a superpower need to have nuclear weapons? Right now, it looks like it's part of their owned items that beyond the economy and the energy, the weapons of mass destruction include the nuclear weapons. So check mark on that yes, they do have them. If you're going to be a superpower or you're going to be a powerful nation, you need to win one of those. Others have acquired the nuclear weapons or technology to make nuclear weapons. They have done some testing, but they're not necessarily in the top superpower category. There may be some regional powers, but definitely not superpowers. That includes India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel. Those are known to have it. Now, others who had nuclear weapons and gave them up, they gave them willingly, include Ukraine. We discussed about that in 91 to 93. There were all the Bucharest agreements where we took the weapons and we actually mothballed them and used them for other purposes. Belarus, the same thing. Kazakhstan, the same thing. So when Russia broke up, those three countries had weapons and they gave them back. The other one that willingly gave it up most recently, or the most recent example, not most recently in time now, was South Africa. So South Africa does no longer have nuclear weapons. So having that is a projection of power as well. Now, what I discussed last two episodes in the program was the alliances. I think the alliance is a multiplier, a force multiplier. It's a 2x, 3x, 5x, because getting together with your friends and allies who all somehow occupy a different geography around the world makes a huge difference. Not only now you sum up their economic power. So from the top 10, the G7, for example, as we were discussing, part of our in our alliances, we have Japan, Germany, India, UK, and France. So only one out of the seven, they're not in with us in the Western side. If you exclude India, the majority fall into the Western category. Even if you go to the G20, the alliances make a huge difference. They swing the factor of the superpower projection, and the leader of that alliance gets to become the hegemon in good terms. As far as the United States is concerned, we're not an abusive hegemon. We are a leader of that system, of the Western system, but we are the catalyst. We make things happen. We provide the nuclear umbrella. We provide huge amounts of the exports to the other economies, and we trade with them. So we are a force for good, for that influence. So our power rests on our shared values with the allies. So NATO, for example, or the EU. So NATO is firstly a liberal political alliance, not just a military defense alliance. So it brings, since 1949, it brings countries that they think alike for their political system and their physical defense. That, as you can see, there are 30 countries in NATO. There are more than that in the EU that overlaps that, the NATO overlaps that, which is the United European Union. It's clearly a political and economic alliance. So it brings the parties, the countries that they used to fight against each other for hundreds of years in Europe, it brings them together now in a political cohesive system. It's not exactly perfected yet. Obviously, the North and South, East and West have differences, as we see. The East, Poland, Romania, Ukraine, Estonia, etc., they're not as, in this example of the Ukrainian war, they're not on the same page as the French and the Germans. They may be together with the UK, but they're not all aligned. And if you go north to south, the northern countries are more very strong politically, very strong economically, very conservative fiscally. Compare that with the southern Europe, where you have the Greeks, the Italians, the Portuguese, the Spaniards. They view life differently. But the alliance is a very cohesive alliance that makes the system work so much better. So expanding on that, as I had explained, there's in the Indo-Pacific now the latest developments with AUKUS, the Australian, United States, and United Kingdom coming together, the Five Eyes. Japan and South Korea are coming together. Japan and Australia are coming together. Philippines are in the fold. The Five Eyes are in. It's now the other alliances are gelling that are helping the superpower that is leading that effort to be even more secure in its position. Furthermore, to the Abraham Accords in the Middle East, that allies of the hegemon are now connecting with each other, therefore avoiding a lot of wars and helping economic situations, exchange trades. That is a plus, a major plus. And now the latest of Israel, India, United Arab Emirates, Emirates, and USA coming together. Now that spans across continents, and that makes that alliance even better. Now, on the other hand, China has only one that is identifiable as something that is forming, but it's not as strong, nearly as strong, as the ones that that glue together the Western system. I wouldn't say the Western Hemisphere, but the Europeans, the Indians, Japanese. We have that Western system. They're trying, between Russia and China, they're trying to put this other system together. It's called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And there are conflicting visions among its growing membership. That's why I think it poses little threat to the West right now. So the SCO, that is called, was founded in 2001 by China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. Obviously very Asian-oriented, to discuss security and economic matters in Central Asia. That's what it was. At that time, terrorism in Afghanistan was brewing. The U.S. was present there. Eventually, NATO stepped in 2003 in Afghanistan. So they looked at that as they wanted to fight terrorism and strengthen their trade links, those Asian countries. So they have conducted some military exercises, but they don't have a formal defense alliance. It's not NATO. It's not even getting closer to get there. So now our different countries are coming in. India and Pakistan were granted full membership in 2017, obviously. The neighborhood is growing. There are a lot of infights within the neighborhood. India with China, India with Pakistan, Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's a lot of inner workings that are negative to this. Now Iran is coming into the fold. Obviously, neighbor to Pakistan, Iran is coming into the fold. Afghanistan is coming in, Belarus, Mongolia, they have observer status. And now Turkey wants to be in and Saudi Arabia. So obviously Turkey cannot be on both sides. They can be, it's not the Warsaw Pact equivalent that you can be on both sides of the equation. So they have to choose. And that's why I call Turkey a loose cannon of an ally in the past, and I think they are grabbing anything that they can find to become more relevant in the world, in the world of their sphere, in their neighborhood. Definitely cannot project power beyond their geography. Saudi Arabia wants to be there, yes. So now you see Iran in there, Afghanistan, Iran, kind of they're it's just rolling. So Saudi Arabia being there, I wouldn't call Saudi Arabia a military power by any stretch of the imagination, but they're folding in because others in the neighborhood are in, so they don't want to miss out, in my view. A good political move for them, but it's I don't know how much they can be effective being in that organization. Russia obviously is part of it, Russia with Syria is if you call that an alliance. Some factions in Libya, if you call that an alliance. So that's where it stops. Venezuela is not a major player. You just say Iran and Russia are together there. They have a presence in some ships. It doesn't make sense. Nothing creates any power out of that. So, and then we get to the next power projector in the superpower. And so far, if you're keeping record, I think the West, i.e. the United States, is the superpower that comes in terms of the military, in terms of the economic staying power, although China is there. The BRICS are coming up, but not all. India, energy, it's all the United States, where China is an importer. Weaponry, it's distributed. It's almost a non-player. The alliances make a huge difference towards the United States. So coming into the size of the military. So size matters. But I will give you the following. It's not the size of the dog in the fight, but the size of the fight in the dog that matters. I've heard from active military personnel that said that, we'll address it as China, they are not 7 feet tall, and they're definitely punching below their weight. So we can say what the size is, as we have seen with Russia, but that's where the intelligence activities come in to put them into perspective. Are they hollow? Saddam Hussein, the largest army in the Middle East. Nothing. Really, not effective. So size matters for statistics, but the deployable power and the effective power is what matters. And I will show you that with the alliances that we have and the interoperability that we have is what makes the military power coming in out of the Western system, i.e. the United States, hegemonic powers, the U.S. is still the superpower in that respect. Although the others are up and coming. But the rankings are as follows. By the way, I will explain how the United States system works and why it's so big. But the rankings of the largest military power is the United States, Russia, China, India, Japan, South Korea, France, United Kingdom, Pakistan, Turkey, Italy, Germany, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Spain, Australia, Israel. That is by the way of how many personnel they have, standing armies, and how much weaponry do they have. So there was a ranking system that ranked the armies accordingly, and these are the top 20 that I mentioned to you. When it comes to projection, obviously an Air Force needs a place to land, i.e. needs land. An army needs boots to put on the ground, therefore it needs land to put boots on the ground. But 70% of the world is water. So we're looking at the Navy as the ultimate projection of power around the world. So if we look at the size of the navies and the components that make the size of the Navy, it will give you a little bit of an insight of what this projection is or potentially can be. So the blue water navies, obviously, in this a ship, if it's not there, it's not there. If you have less ships and you don't have presence in one area, you can have half of a ship here and half of a ship there. So you either have a ship or you don't. So in that respect, size matters. How many ships, how many capital ships or other ships you have in your fleet. But all, obviously, quality of the ships matter and quality of their capabilities matter. So when it comes to the blue water navies, China has the biggest numbers. Not by far. China has the biggest numbers. I have a ranking here where it says China has, I am looking at a website. China has 2 aircraft carriers, 69 amphibious warfare ships, 0 cruisers, 36 destroyers, 52 frigates, 42 corvettes, 14 nuclear submarines, and 45 other submarines. Compared to the United States, that has 11 aircraft carriers. These are groups. 21 frigates, 27 corvettes, 70 submarines. All of them are nuclear. So the if you compare aircraft carriers and aircraft carriers, so they're totally different, and we'll explain. Following the United States, we have Russia as the next navy. And after that is Japan, United States, India, France, South Korea, Italy, and Indonesia. Okay? Indonesia, it is a sizable military power in both ways, obviously, big islands. So the quality of, let's say, an aircraft carrier. Our aircraft carriers are nuclear-powered. They stay out in sea indefinitely. Their usual mission is somewhere between 6 and 8 months, and then they come back. There are 11 of them. They're spread around the world from different fleets, east and west, different hemispheres. They're constantly deployed, constantly out there. About 5,000 personnel on each ship. Somewhere it's 65 to 75 aircraft, depends on what the mission is. Compare that to the Chinese, which now are there on the, they're building their third. The first two were copies of Ukrainian designs with a ski jump, where ours are either steam catapult or now electromagnetic catapult. Technologies are totally different. We've been operating since 1942, 43, these capital ships. Our quality is unsurpassed. You can't even compare the two. When Russia had its first aircraft carrier, it was small. It was like 15, 16 airplanes and a lot of choppers. They mainly made them to hunt submarines than to be an aircraft carrier unit, a strike unit. Our aircraft carrier group by itself, that includes some corvettes, some destroyers, submarines, some supply ships, when they are present somewhere, it changes the balance of the power in that region. You know, an aircraft carrier may be larger than the air force of a country, and this is just in one ship. So it makes a huge difference. So the replenishments, which is a critical part of being out in the water forever, replenishment and basing. The United States has bases throughout the world, hundreds of them throughout the world. We have our own bases, and we have bases with our allies, and that makes a huge difference. For example, when in 2014 the single aircraft carrier that left Russia, I'm not sure if it left from the Archangels, from the you know north of the Arctic Circle, or left from St. Petersburg through through the Baltic Sea, it requested to refuel somewhere in the Gibraltar Cross, either Spain or Portugal. Imagine that. Imagine your adversary asking for permission to land and refuel. You know, they had some issues. The only refueling and resupplying that the U.S. ships need is jet fuel for the planes and food and provisions for the crew. They make their own water. They are very self-sufficient. This makes what a blue navy is. In China's case, they have a base in Djibouti. They are building a base in Karachi. They were attempting to build a base in West Africa. But there, obviously, they built some of the islands around the South China Sea, the Nine Dash Line. But that's it. Their experience is growing. But let's put it in context. They can't sustain what we have, and they're not everywhere. So basing and supplying is critical. Now, we have something else. I mean, our nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, to make that very clear, they are the epitome of technology and the ultimate weapon. I believe in the 1962 crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis, why Khrushchev pulled back was he was afraid from the counterstrike from the nuclear submarines that we had. They would not have an ability to counter our strike. even though they were able from Cuba to land missiles along the east coast of the United States, our superiority in technology of our nuclear boomers, our nuclear-tipped submarines, they were the fear that they will not be able to overcome that strike. So even though they hit us, that second or third step that he was going to take, he was going to be impaired. So they pulled back. We're making now the investment in AUKUS in the East Pacific with Australia and Japan, and I wouldn't be surprised if Japan gets into the nuclear submarines that we have, because we share a lot of technology with them, we share space technology with them, we share a lot. So that could be the next step. And the Russians back in the 80s went broke trying to build a fleet to counter us. After 1991, after the second war, after the first Iraqi war, we retired a ship, a capital ship, the USS Wisconsin. We retired it after we brought it back to fight in that war, and we put all the latest technologies in it. But it was an old ship. It was an old capital ship. I mean, a good airplane with Exocet missiles, et cetera, would have taken it down. But the Russians invested a lot in that, and they also invested a lot in their nuclear capable submarines. They wanted to hunt down our submarines. Unbeknownst to them, they were very noisy. In the 50s and 60s and 70s, and we continue to this day, we have a system, a system that is embedded in the water, in the oceans. It's called the SOSUS system, S-O-S-U-S, where we have hydrophones everywhere, and we listen, and we know where they are. We know who. Every ship, every submarine has its unique signature, like a fingerprint. And we know where they are. And they were very noisy, although very fast underwater. We knew where they were. And that defeated them. That actually broke their bank trying to build that technology. And we didn't know as much as that. And if you remember, I had mentioned that in 1974, we pulled a submarine out of the Pacific Ocean, is a sunken submarine, Russian, that had an accident and it went to the very deep ends, 4,000, 5,000 feet. And we recovered it partially, and we were looking to see how they were made, because we knew they were noisy. But just we wanted to know what technology is, how far ahead we are, or if not. So we figured out that our economic power broke their economic system that was falling behind. So moving on from that, we own the technologies. We own a lot of technologies. We're very efficient in bringing technologies. We're very efficient in our investments. The Belt and Road system that the Chinese have, it created such a backlash. We do 90% grants and 10% loans, where they do 90% loans, 10% grants. They look at different projects, infrastructure projects, you know, we call it project finance projects, bridges, railroads, tunnels. So we gave them, or they gave the ability to other countries to build, but then they saddled them with a lot of loans that they were bad. So to summarize, our common law and our global currency is the strength that is in addition to our powers, to our economic powers. Their renminbi, their currency, the Chinese currency, cannot take over the world and be the number one besides United States dollar. So the dollar is the king. And we will be here. We are still the only superpower right now. And I believe with the arguments that I made that we will stay to be the power for the foreseeable future, and we will continue our goodwill for the global good. Thank you for listening, and have a great weekend.
This is your community radio station, serving Lower Fairfield County and Westchester. 1490 WGCH in Greenwich,